Welcome to Dime Library, where this week we commence the story, The League of Three, or Buffalo Bill's Pledge, a story of a trail followed to the bitter end by three famous scouts, Buffalo Bill, Wild Bill, and Texas Jack, the Princes of the Plains, by Colonel Prentice Ingraham, author of Wild Bill the Pistol Deadshot, Merle the Mutineer, Gold, Plume the Boy Bandit, Bison Bill, Prince of the Rains, Crimson Kate, Lone Star, the Cowboy, Captain, etc. Chapter 1. The Ranchero's Train. Father, you seem worried. I must frankly confess that I am, Madge, for though a stranger in this wild land of the West, I am certain that something is going wrong. But what, Father? You remember that the gentleman, whose ranch I bought, gave me what he called a map of the trail we were to follow. Yes, sir. Here it is, and it keeps tally with our course according to each day's travel up to yesterday. And then I noticed that our guide took a different route, which is not laid out here. As today's course was also wholly at variance with the map, I spoke to him about it, and he said he was not a paper guide and knew his trail thoroughly. Perhaps he does, Father, and the map may be wrong. No, Madge, for Waller told me he took the trail, as marked down, every time he went and to and from Omaha. And if I followed his directions, I needed no guide. And now we are many, many miles away from it, heading up the North Fork of the Loup River, when we should be following the Platte. What do the teamsters say, sir? They say the guide is wrong. Yet he should know. He does know, Madge. Father, you have some secret you are keeping from me. I will tell you all, for you are a brave girl, Madge, and your advice will aid me. I will do all in my power to aid you, Father, and what you must do must be done promptly, if you do suspect the guide, for this is no country to be at the mercy of an evil man, sir. Well, yesterday morning, you know, I gave chase to an antelope, and it led me some distance from camp. Upon returning, I saw two horsemen talking earnestly together, and I halted and leveled my glass. One was Kiowa Carl, our guide. And the other? Was a stranger, Madge, and as well as I could judge with my glass, at the distance I stood, a most villainous-looking fellow. Not one of our train, then? No, for I never saw him before. Did you speak with him? No, Madge. I saw them talking earnestly together, and I rode on to camp, and shortly after the guide came into the camp, and he was alone. This was strange. Yes. When you take into consideration that we are far from any settlement, or even habitation, it seemed but natural to bring him into camp. So I would think, sir. But did you not speak to the guide about the stranger? Not directly, but I asked him if there were any ranches near, and he said no. I then asked if it was probable for us to meet anyone on our route, and he answered that we might strike a train, or perhaps a band of roving redskins, but no one else. And he did not speak of his meeting the stranger. He did not. This looks strange indeed, Father. And stranger still, when he at once, upon our starting, left the trail I have marked down on my map by Waller, and took this course up the loop. When we camp tonight, I should demand of him, as is your right, why he has thus led you off from what you know to be the direct trail, and ask who it was he was talking to upon the prairie yesterday morning. I will do so, for I confess I am worried at his conduct. Yet he was well recommended to you, Father. Yes, by others of his stripe, and from the day we started I have not liked him. Nor I, for I can only see his eyes beneath his bushy hair and immense beard, and they have a glitter I do not like. Shh! There he comes. And the father and daughter relapsed into silence as the subject of their conversation approached them. The father was an elderly gentleman of 50, with a genial, fine face, and the air of one who had lived well and was in good circumstances. He was dressed in corduroy, top boots, and wore on his head the western sombrero, and around his waist a belt of arms. He was well mounted upon a large roan mare, and at his saddle horn hung a lariat and a repeating rifle. The daughter was a maiden of 19, with dark violet eyes, shaded by sweeping lashes, the flash of perfect health upon her face, which the prairie sun had turned brown as a berry, and one who, in any assemblage, would have been pronounced a decided beauty. Her face was frank, fearless, and kind, and the merry twinkle that flashed in her eyes showed that life had held for her far more roses than thorns. She was dressed in a gray corduroy riding habit, which showed her faultless form in every graceful motion, and her small hands were encased in a gauntlet of kid gloves, while her head was sheltered by a gray sombrero, the broad brim looped up on the side with a gold pin, a miniature spur, and upon the other was a heavy black plume that touched her shoulder. Her horse was a dark chestnut, and like her father's, showed the thoroughbred blood. Behind these two came an army ambulance, drawn by a pair of immense mules and driven by a Negro, and it was seated in a prim-looking lady who might be classed among that much-abused army of virgins known as old maids. She was dressed in similar style to the young maiden, riding habit and all, though she never had been on horseback in her life. But the dressmaker had a different form to fit in making her dress, and the angles would show here and there. Behind this ambulance came a second, also drawn by a mule, but with a roguish-faced youth as driver and a Negro woman as passenger, and a glance was sufficient to show that she was in her right element, as around her were innumerable utensils of a culinary nature. Following the ambulances came six prairie schooners in Western parlance, but which, upon being interpreted, meant wagons with white tilts or coverings of canvas. These were evidently heavily loaded and drawn by spiked teams of mules and horses, four animals being hitched to each vehicle, while the drivers were real types of the border teamsters, rough-faced, roughly clad men, all thoroughly armed. In the last wagon were visible several sheep, hogs, and a coop of chickens, and another of ducks and geese, while behind it were half a dozen fine horses and as many cattle, all of which went to prove that the gentleman at the head of the train was going to make himself comfortable in the border home toward which he was wending his way. There is another person to describe, and the train and its people will be complete, and that personage is Kiowa Carl, the guide, whose mysterious conduct had brought suspicion upon him. Chapter 2. A Leaf from the Bygone. Mr. Mabry Markham was an Englishman by birth, whose father had sent him to sea before the mast to make a man of him, he said, while a brother, some 6 years his senior, had been kept at home and reared to become a gentleman, which would fit him as heir for the Markham estate. The young Mabry had felt his father's unkindness to him so deeply that he did not return home in the ship in which he had shipped, but he went off instead on his own responsibility to make a name and fortune for himself. Some 10 years after, his father died, and not having heard of the young sailor since departure, he left to his oldest son, Daniel, his entire fortune. At the funeral, as the services were being read by the clergyman, and the aristocratic assemblages were sitting with bowed hands and feigned grief, a seafaring man in duck pants, blue woolen shirt, black tie, and sailor hat, entered and stood in respectful silence near the door. He was a stranger to all, with a bearded face, sober mane, and the air of one who had seen better days. He followed the cortege from the elegant mansion to the grave, stood with uncovered head while the clods fell with hollow sound upon the coffin, and then, alone, wended his way back to the home, to the heir to the Markham Manor. The proud butler looked at him with a supercilious glance when he asked to see Mr. Daniel Markham, and said, "You must be an ignoramus to call on a gent in his deep grief to beg alms." The sailor smiled and answered without a show of anger, "Abner, go and tell Daniel Markham that his brother Mabry would like to see him." The butler started, glanced earnestly into the bearded face, and saw in the man a resemblance to the boy, and he said quickly, "Pardon me, Master Markham, but I did not recognize you, sir. You have changed so." "I'll tell the master, sir, and he will be glad to see you." The butler disappeared and soon returned with a message. "The master says he does not wish to be disturbed by beggars, even if they are of his kin, and that he will not see you now or at any other time, but to give you this 10-pound note and tell you to leave." The butler had resumed his proud manner and held forth the banknote with the air of a prince conferring a favor upon a poor servitor. Again the sailor smiled, but almost immediately his smile turned into a look of intense sadness, and his face grew ashen pale. But he said after an effort, and his voice trembled, "Give me a pen, ink, and paper, Abner." The butler seemed maligned to refuse, but there was that in the look and manner of the seaman that commanded respect, and he bowed and he obeyed. At the hall table, Mabry Markham sat down and wrote something on the leaf of a book he took from his pocket. The leaf he tore out, And then, upon the piece of paper brought by the butler, he wrote, Markram Manor, June 10th, 18 dash. Brother. After 10 long years of absence, I returned home in time to see my father buried and to be refused admission into my own boyhood home by you. I came not to seek alms, nor to beg to share with you an inheritance which I could justly claim with you, but to revisit old scenes, to beg forgiveness of my father and of you for not having in all these years let you know that I was alive and happy. The silent lips of my father gave me no welcome, and from your lips has only insult come. But I forgive you, brother, and I bid you farewell. Yet I leave with you a commission to execute, and that is to place above the grave of our parents a monument with this inscription, to the memory of Daniel Markham and his wife Margaret. This monument is erected by their son, Mabry. Within this note, you will find my draft on the Bank of England for £2,000 to defray the cost of the monument, the design of which I leave to your taste. Do this for me, brother, and no more will you hear from me. Mabry Markham. The sailor handed his letter to the butler, and without a word turned upon his heel and departed from the home of his boyhood. And the rich heir cast aside the note given him by the butler, and paced to and fro with moody brow, for remembrance of the past welled up before him, and he recalled the scenes of their younger years together, when he had really loved the bright-faced boy, his younger brother, who had followed him on so many hunting and fielding tramps. At last his human nature prevailed over sordid avarice, and he said, I will send after poor Mabry, beg him to forgive me, and share with him the fortune, one half of which is justly his due, and then I certainly will have enough. He seized the letter then, and read it with a look of intense surprise, and glanced at the check. Great God, I have made a mistake, and a bitter one. Mabry came not to ask for aid, for he is rich, I should think, and if he can give so large a sum to the memory of our parents, I dare not send for him now, for he shall think that I did so only when I found out that he was not a pauper. Let him go, until again we drift across each other's path, and I will take care to find out all about him, which I can do through the bank which he has had his deposits. And I will erect the monument he desires, placed over the grave of our parents, and it will serve as a rebuke to me through life, for I had never thought of so honoring their memory. Kind reader, I hear you ask, what has this, some faraway England, to do with this tale of the rolling prairies of America? Simply, that the chief of the train wending its way westward, under the guidance of Kiowa Carl, was Mabry Markham, the one-time sailor who had become an American by adoption, married a pretty Yankee girl, and given up forever a life on the ocean wave. Chapter 3. Kiowa Carl. I will now return to the time when Kiowa Carl, whose strange conduct had caused suspicion to fall upon him, rode up to join Mr. Mabry Markham and his beautiful daughter, Madge, who were sitting at the head of the train. Well, guide, is there any news? Asked Mabry Markham, as the guide rode back and joined them. The one he addressed was mounted upon a large, long-bodied, gaunt black that showed both speed and endurance, and his bridle and saddle trappings were really elegant. The rider was a man of fine physique, broad-shouldered, and with a face that was hidden beneath a mass of beard, long hair, and the fact that his broad-brimmed sombrero came to his eyebrows, leaving only a pair of dark, piercing eyes revealed. He was dressed in a buckskin jacket, leggings stuck in his boot tops, and his blue woolen shirt was open at the neck, displaying his broad, massive chest. A repeating rifle and lariat hung to his saddle horn, and a pair of revolvers and bowie were in his belt, and he looked the man to use the weapons. He said he had passed long years on the prairie, knew the language of half a dozen Indian tribes, and could not be lost on the border. But more than this he did not say of himself, and was, withal, a silent man, with a reserve which no one had broken through, unless it was Madge Markham, and toward her he had shown that whatever he might then be, he had, in the past, led a far different life, for he had told her tales of other lands in which he had traveled, sung for her at night around the campfire, and in every way in his power had tried to ingratiate himself into her favor. But Madge admired his nerve, praised his deadly aim with pistol and rifle, flattered him upon his superb horsemanship, thought him handsome and agreeable, yet could not bring herself to like him. There was something far back in his dark eyes that she feared and could not understand. After the death of his wife, the mother of Madge, Mr. Markham's home had been broken up, and the father and daughter had traveled for more than a year. But, his means being limited, he had determined to settle down, and he had purchased from a friend a cattle ranch in Nebraska, hoping to make there a happy home for himself and for Madge. With every comfort and many luxuries, he had started for the ranch, and Kiowa Carl had been the guide he had selected to take him there with his train, which, besides his teamsters, who were to remain as cowboys at the ranch, consisted of a distant relative of his wife, Miss Samantha Doolittle of New Hampshire, who acted as housekeeper. Then there was Don Caesar de Bazan, a Negro factotum, who was known under the more familiar title of Coon, and his wife, Dorothy de Bazan. The youth driving the second ambulance was a waif whom Mr. Markham had picked up in Omaha before starting, in answer to the spicy appellation of Pepper. Having now made the reader acquainted with those who are to figure prominently in my romance of the Land of the Setting Sun, I will now give Kiowa Carl's answer to the question of Mr. Markham's, "Well, guide, is there any news?" "This is not the place to get the daily papers, Mr. Markham," was the somewhat rude reply. "Yet it is a place where it behooves one to look after his own safety and not leave it wholly in the hands of others, so I ask why have you left the trail marked out on my map?" And it was evident that Mr. Markham was nettled. Noticing the manner of his employer, with a quick glance at Madge, the guide answered in an earnest tone, "Mr. Markham, as I told you before, I am no paper guide, but one who acts for the good of my employer, and as you seem to doubt me, I will now frankly tell you why I left the trail." "I will hear you with pleasure, sir," was the cold reply. "I learned, through a courier crossing the country, that there were Indians on the lower trail, and hence I made this detour." "Ah, then, I did not tell you, sir, for I cared not to alarm you or Miss Markham needlessly, and by making a circuit up the loop, I hoped to avoid all danger." "Forgive me, guide, for I frankly confess that I doubted you," said Mr. Markham honestly. "I must ask for forgiveness also, sir," said Madge, with one of her sweet smiles. The guide smiled and bowed, but said quietly, "I'll now ride to yonder mont, you see it in the distance, and I'll lay out a camp for the night." Without another word, he turned his horse and rode away at a swinging lope, while the train followed more slowly on, the father and daughter conversing earnestly together and regretting the wrong they had done their guide, until they were startled by a loud cry from Coon. "Master Markham, Master Markham!" Quickly they turned, while Mr. Markham asked, "Well, Coon, what is it?" "That white boy, he sees everything. Done dare that man on horseback coming, sir?" "Yes, I see him. He's coming to wrap it on our trail, Madge, so let us ride back to meet him." And the father and daughter turned their horses to meet the stranger who was coming at a swift gallop toward this train. Chapter 4. The Strange Horseman. The strange horseman, whose evident pursuit of the train had just caught the ever-watchful eyes of the youth, Pepper, came up within the straggling cattle just as Mr. Markham and Madge got there. Both father and daughter gave expression to their surprise and admiration by a slight exclamation as their eyes fell on the superb-looking man before them. He reined his horse back to a halt, raised his broad sombrero, and bent low in his saddle at sight of Madge, a courtly salute, which the maiden returned with a gracious bow, and her father by touching his hat. The horse, a steed as white as milk, and with a long flowing mane and tail, did not seem in the least fatigued by his rapid gallop, and arched his proud neck, and seemed the personification of animal beauty, as was his master of manly strength and elegance. The attire of the stranger was fancy and handsome enough for a bal masque costume, being a mixture of Mexican and frontier garb, to which was added cavalry boots, with massive spurs of gold, a plumed sombrero of dove-colored felt, encircled by gold cord, and looped up upon one side by a pin of solid gold, representing a buffalo, with large diamonds for eyes, amber for horns, and rubies to give the red glare of the nostrils. It was certainly a unique and costly trinket for a border man to wear, but was in keeping with the diamond solitaire that glittered in his black silk necktie, and a chain of massive links of gold that encircled his neck and had attached to a watch which was hidden in the fob in his hunting shirt. His feet were small and shapely, his hands encased in gauntlet gloves, and his whole bearing in keeping with a man who did as he pleased ask no favors or mercy of palefaces or redskin, and lived without fear. All this, both Mr. Markham and Madge took in at a glance as the man approached, but when he drew nearer and they gazed into his face mentally, they confessed that they were gazing upon a most remarkable personage, for no woman could have possessed more clearly cut features or eyes more expressive and full of feeling. His mouth, slightly stern, was half hidden beneath a dark, silken mustache, and his resolute, well-rounded chin by an imperial, while his hair was waving and fell down upon his back halfway to his waist, a circumstance which, when one did not gaze fully in his face, gave him a look of effeminacy. But one look into his large, earnest eyes, and the stern, somewhat reckless, daredevilish mouth, and it would be a most casual observer that would not set him down as any other than a true man, a prince of the plains. Fully 6 feet in height, and shaped like an Apollo, it was no wonder that he, at a glance, won the admiration of Mr. Markham and Madge. "Pardon me, sir, but may I ask who is chief of this train?" asked the strange horseman in a clear, tenor-like voice. "I am, sir," was Mr. Markham in reply. "I hope, sir, that it is not your intention to attempt a settlement upon the loop, as your course implies," resumed the stranger in an inquiring way. "By no means, sir, for I am bound to a ranch I have purchased upon the Platte."
"The Platte, sir?"
"Yes, for I have purchased the Waller Ranch and its cattle."
"The Platte, sir, is not in this direction," said the stranger with some surprise.
"So I know, sir, but my guide, who has ridden on ahead to find a camping ground for the night, makes this detour to avoid bands of Indians on the direct trail," explained Mr. Markham, while Madge sat on her horse attentively regarding the strange horseman, who, interested apparently in what her father said, did not glance toward her.
"Why, I have just come from Fort McPherson along the river trail. I have seen no traces of redskins, nor heard of any at Fort Kearney, for I halted there, where I am just getting dispatches, sir, from McPherson to Omaha.
My guide met someone who told him there were Indians on our trail."
"He was misinformed, I assure you, sir, for there is no man on the border who knows better than I the movements of the hostiles."
This was said with no air of braggadocio, and Mr. Markham replied,
"That being the case, we have come a long way off our course for nothing."
"You have indeed, sir, and another day on this trail will take you right into the Indian country, where your train would fall an easy prey to massacre."
"My dear sir, you surprise me, for I cannot understand how my guide could have been so ignorant of the facts you state."
"Who is your guide, may I ask?"
"He is known in Omaha, where I engaged him, as Kiowa Carl."
Both Mr. Markham and Madge saw the start the stranger gave, while he answered promptly,
"I know him, sir, as an infamous scoundrel, and he bears upon his right ear my mark. That man, sir, was leading you into a trap, for he's friendly with old Blackface, the chief of the tribe into whose clutches this trail will take you."
These words fell like a thunderclap upon both Mr. Markham and Madge, and they sat staring in amazement upon the strange horseman before them. Chapter 5. The Prince of the Platte. "My dear sir, you astound me," at last Mr. Markham found the words to say. "Kiowa Carl would have astounded you still more, sir, had I not struck your trail, and knowing that no train could come up here, feared you were lost, and came on to warn you. And most heartily do I thank you, sir, for your manner, your face, carry a conviction with all you say."
"I also join my father, sir, in thanking you," said Madge softly.
The stranger's face flushed, and he said quickly, "I seek not thanks, nor do I want them, for doing my duty. My orders are imperative to press on to Omaha, but I felt I would not be doing my duty to allow you to go on this trail when I knew your force, so came to warn you."
"May I ask how you knew what force I had?" asked Mr. Markham.
"It is as plain to me, sir, as is the lightning and thunder a precursor of the storm, for I read trails as an open book. See, there are the trails of your ambulances and wagons, half blurred out by a few cattle, and I knew that you could not have more than a dozen fighting men, which in this country would be a mere handful against old Blackface and his braves, more especially if you were led into an ambush."
"I see, sir, that you read signs on the prairie as one would an open book, for my fighting force does not number a dozen all told."
"You say that your guide has gone on to prepare you a campground?"
"Yes, so he said,
the more likely to arrange his red allies into an ambush for you."
Both Mr. Markham and Madge paled slightly, while the former said anxiously,
"Then what is to be done, sir?"
For a moment the stranger was silent, and then he said,
"If you ask my advice, it's to go no further."
Yet your duty will not permit you to guide us. No, it will not, I regret to say, unless... He paused, and Madge quickly said, Your manner implies that there is a possibility that you may do so. Lady, were your father alone, that is, were there only men in this train, I would set them on the right trail and tell them to look to their manhood and prowess to pull through all right. But with yourself and, as I see, another lady in the train, I feel that it is my duty to make every sacrifice. But first we will settle about Kiowa Carl, and then I will decide what is best to be done. And what would you advise about him? Asked Mr. Markham. Catch him, was the laconic response. But how? He has gone to yonder motte. So he said. He is not in sight on the prairie. No, he was just disappearing when we sighted you. Then he does not know of my coming? He cannot possibly do so. Then we'll fetch him back to the train. Yet how can we do that? Halt your train, call all your men about one wagon, as though it had broken down, and then wait until he discovers that you are delayed. Well, sir? Naturally, he'll return, and here on the open prairie, you have him at your mercy. And you advise that we seize him? Oh, no, sir. I will do that. You? Yes, leave him to me, for I will keep in the background until the proper moment to act. And then?
And then you will see he knows who I am, and that I am aware that he is a black-hearted villain. You will not kill him, said Madge timidly. No, miss, for I never take the life of a human being without its absolute necessity, was the response, and Madge breathed more freely, as she had feared that she would be compelled to witness one of those dread scenes for which the far frontier was noted, and of which she had incidentally heard so much.
I will at once do as you suggest, sir, said Mr. Markham, as he rode forward and halted the train, for the three had been riding at the rear during the conversation that took place. In a few moments the train had come to a halt. Mr. Markham had explained to the men the tidings brought by the strange horseman, and all gathered around one of the wagons, as though engaged in mending a broken-down vehicle. Back in the rear the stranger waited, standing by the side of his superb horse, and conversing with Mr. Markham and Madge. Eagerly, Mr. Markham watched for the returning form of the guide, and thus nearly an hour passed away. At last the eye of the stranger, as powerful in sight as a glass, caught sight of the guide, and he said simply, He is coming. Ah, I see him now. And Mr. Markham gazed earnestly at him through his field glass, as did Madge, who remarked, You have marvelous eyes, sir, for he is yet very far off, and he is returning at a gallop, which will bring him here in half an hour. You have indeed superb sight, sir, said Mr. Markham. The sight of the prairie man, sir, as with a sailor, improves by long practice in searching vast expanses, where a failure to detect a foe brings death. Hence, it is most necessary to innervate one's vision, and though I carry a glass, it is seldom I need its use, was the reply. Well, sir, have you decided upon what you shall do when the guide returns? Asked Mr. Markham somewhat nervously, as the returning form of the horse and rider grew each instant more distinct. Yes, sir. May I ask what it is you will do? Certainly, sir. Please go forward with your daughter to where the men are, and when Kiowa Carl comes up and asks the cause of your delay, simply tell him that you have decided to retrace your trail and take the right one along the Platte. And then? I will attend to the balance, sir, was the calm reply.
Mr. Markham nodded, and rode forward with Madge, leaving the stranger concealed behind the rear wagon. A quarter of an hour passed, the whole party gathered in a group about the center of the train, and waiting somewhat nervously the coming of the guide, whom all seemed to fear. Presently up he dashed, and asked sternly, "What means the long halt here, when there hardly is time to catch a campground before night?" "It means, Kiowa Carl, that I have decided to go no further upon this trail," was Mr. Markham's firm response. "Ha! Do you intend to assume the duties of guide, sir?" was the angry response. Mr. Markham hesitated, and then came in deep tones, "No, but I do, Kiowa Carl." The man started back, jerking cruelly upon his rein until he forced his horse upon his haunches, and while his face became pallid, he cried in a startled tone, "Great God, Buffalo Bill, the Prince of the Platte!" The stranger had stepped boldly out before him from behind one of the wagons and held his revolver leveled at the guide. His face was smiling now, and he answered in a free and easy way,
Correct, Kiowa Carl, and I have the drop on you.